Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. With the ISIS militants nearly wiped out, the tension in the Middle East appears to be calming down. But the question, how did this group attracted so many people from so many places, remain a topic of interest for researchers. And the latest report produced by Royal United Services Institute looks into the recruitment of Central Asians among the labor workers in Russia, their methodology, tactics, and etc. The report, based on the ground conversation with so many people, certainly brings some new perspective to the similar existing reports. And as the Central Asia focused podcast, we are here to discuss its findings. To do so, I'm joined from London, Rafael Pantucci, director of the Institute's International Security Studies, who is also one of the co-authors of the report. Marinta Miles is with us from George Mason University in Washington, D.C., where she is pursuing her doctoral studies on the intersection of society, politics, and religion in Tajikistan. Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Kishlok Awazi is with us from Prague. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us on this important discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Very, very nice to have you. So, Rafael, thank you for this important study. There are a lot that we can talk about this. So let's start with the report itself. So who was involved and how did you obtain the information presented in it?
Thank you for the invitation. And I have to say that, you know, me being on the podcast by myself belies the fact that there was a very substantial team that was working on this. And in particular, I want to signal my colleague Mohammed Al-Shimi, who really took the lead in helping draft it and was really sort of instrumental in constructing the methodology around this project. This was really a team effort from our perspective, not least because it was a very difficult project to do. I mean, implicit within your question is the question of how one actually achieves capability as a British think tank to interview groups of Central Asian labor migrants working in Russia on the very sensitive question of radicalization. And the way that we did this was working closely with partners in Central Asia and partners in Russia to actually undertake the research. So what we did was in the Russian context, we were working very closely with the Institute of Oriental Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences. It was Vitaly Naumkin and his team who were really helping us there. And then in Central Asia, we had a search for common grounds. Bishkek office was kind of leading the effort in recruiting and working with some Central Asian researchers. And what we did was we got these Central Asian researchers to ultimately be the ones who went out into the different Russian cities and all across Russia to ultimately do the interviews. What we did was we formulated the kind of methodology, we formulated the questionnaire, and we talked through with our Russian colleagues and our Central Asian colleagues to understand how we'd be able to really ask these difficult questions and to prepare the researchers to actually go out and do this research.
Tell us a little bit about the methodology you mentioned.
Well, I mean, the methodology was essentially, you know, we concluded that it was probably going to be very difficult for our researchers to be able to go out and actually interview radicalized individuals. You know, we had to, what we did is we said, well, let's try to focus on trying to understand the milieu in which this radicalization is purportedly taking place. I think all of us who look at Central Asia and look at questions of radicalization in the region, or actually in Syria and Iraq, will have heard these stories that, you know, if you're looking at the Central Asians who are going to fight in Syria and Iraq, you know, a lot of them in the background of their histories, you'll find evidence of them having been labor migrants in Russia. So, you know, the corollary is that maybe there's something happening in Russia that is sort of helping feed this process. So our question was, well, how do we go and explore that? So if we're going to struggle to interview the direct radicalized individuals or potentially people who are in their networks, let's try to talk to people who are around them in the milieu. And so the researchers were basically tasked with, you know, we developed up a questionnaire for them to go out and ask people within these communities. And, you know, we identified, we had groups of Tajik researchers, groups of Uzbek researchers, and groups of Kyrgyz researchers. As we all know, I think those are the three main Central Asian communities that are labor migrants in Russia. And basically they would go and look for communities in different Russian cities of, you know, their co-nationals and go and talk to them and try to put them, ask them questions, understand a little bit more about some of the issues around globalization or some of the potential drivers that we were seeing that we thought could exist within Russia that might push people towards joining a group like ISIS or others in Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, the driving factors, definitely we are going to talk about that a little bit later. I wish we could have Mohammed join us, but, you know, logistics are always a challenge when doing this. So I'm sure, Rafael, you also seen similar reports done in the past about this topic. So in terms of content, what stands out in your report compared to the previous ones?
I mean, I think what was, you know, there's a number of things that kind of stood out. Mm. I think one of the first ones that we thought was particularly significant or interesting is, and this actually confirms a sort of broader thing that we see in questions around radicalization, is this question of the economic incentive. Mm. You know, it was really striking to us that, you know, pretty much everyone we talked to, and even when we looked back and talked to others in Central Asia, the question of the economic incentive as being a motivator for people deciding to go and fight in Syria and Iraq appeared to be higher than you would expect in normal context. If you're talking about sort of radicalization in a Western context, the idea of economic incentives, i.e. people saying, I'm going to go be a fight in Syria and Iraq because it's a good paycheck, is a pretty distant one, you know what I mean? And it's not one that we really ever sort of acknowledge. Yeah. And, you know, it was interesting to see in this context that actually it did really seem that in some cases you saw people genuinely seeing an economic incentive as being a sort of important driver for them. I think the other question was, you know, another thing that distinctly did stand out to us was the degree to which, you know, the migration experience in itself and some of the complexities around it were causing issues that were leading people vulnerable to being drawn towards extremist ideas, you know, and this really was it was a difficult one, frankly, to address with in our sort of international group that we were, because, of course, you know, our Russian partners had a very different view on some of these questions. And, you know, but I think it was also clearly undeniable that, you know, this was a clearly negative experience that was having some sort of impact. So that was sort of an interesting aspect that we thought stood out quite a bit. And then the other aspect, which was also striking, was the degree to which there seemed to be a difference in the kind of experiences between different communities. So, for example, it was interesting to see this question around the complexities around, you know, the migration experience was something that was very pronounced amongst the Tajik communities and the Uzbek communities in particular. For the Kyrgyz, it didn't seem to be as much of an issue. Hmm. Now, the reason that was given was because Kyrgyzstan is part of the Eurasian Economic Union, and therefore, you know, the migration process is just much easier. And it could be sort of as simple as that. But it was quite interesting to see these kind of distinctions. You know, there's lots of other sort of little nuggets which sort of stood out. Or were quite curious, you know. One aspect which was funny was the degree to, or was interesting, was the degree to which people kept pointing to Kyrgyz Uzbeks as a sort of major source of problem. And when we dug into it, you know, we actually struggled to find much evidence beyond that. But it definitely seemed to be a kind of perception that was hanging out in everyone's kind of views.
Wow, you put out a lot to hear.
Sorry, yes.
No, that's great, great. Thank you very much, Rafael. Now, Marinta, Tajikistan is obviously your region of focus, but it mentioned a lot in Rafael's comments. So anything so far, what has been discussed, surprised you?
No, actually, nothing surprised me. I think the report was pretty, it mirrored other research that's come out on the topic.
No, the economic incentives were, as Rafael said, were high, which is kind of new to me. And we discussed about this, obviously, in the past, too. But is it something that strikes out to you? Bruce, Marinta, feel free to jump in.
Well, let Marinta go first.
Yeah,
I will say that in my own research and people I've talked to, and this is, I think, more, I would hate to put too much credence into it. I think it's more anecdotal than anything. There are rumors that migrants are recruited specifically by Chechens with the incentives of money. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at some research on recruits in Libya, there is an economic incentive there too, and there's even different pay scales according to nationality. If there's more experienced fighters that have maybe fought somewhere else, they're going to get paid more than recruits that come from Central Asia. So I have seen some information on that, but again, I think it's anecdotal at best.
Mm-hmm. And Bruce, you were taught?
Well, 3 years ago, I guess we did. Yeah. We had a program, and we were wondering if it was jihad or just a job. You know, and so we did look at that a little bit. You know, it was interesting that after we did that program, some of the reports that came out subsequently, you know, in the year 18 months after that, tended to cast a lot of doubt on that. So I was surprised at the Rusi report. You know, that they said no, actually this was, but it did make sense. You know, I appreciated the way it was explained that these were essentially economic migrants to begin with, looking for work. So if you were unsuccessful in finding the work that you desired, there was an option that was being given to you, you know, and in the real hard luck cases, you know, that might actually be an attractive offer to, and the money certainly was good by the standards of what a migrant laborer is making. Now, you know, a few years ago, we had the Kyrgyz officials, the one, I can't remember his name, but he was saying that they paid these guys like, you know, $2,000 a month. And I'm like, thank you for advertising, you know, this job opportunity for everybody. But, you know, so this was a real problem.
Yeah. And I've heard anything from $500 to $2,000 a month as well. But I think that most of the migrants that were from Central Asia that I heard about that were offered economic incentives, it was more in the $500 a month range. Mm. So yeah. there's that.
What numbers did you get, Rafael?
I mean, I think the numbers that we had were very broad, frankly, speaking. And I, you know, it was everything between the range that we've heard of the extreme one, which, you know, I think one of our commenters, I think I seem to recall one, did refer to that Kyrgyz official's comment, and so he used the same number as he did, which was like 1,000 or 2,000, I can't remember exactly. But the funny thing about that was it wasn't clear to us if that was information the person got themselves or if it was just they were kind of repeating a story that they'd heard. And I think that was a bit of the problem. I mean, the other aspect I would touch upon, which I'd be really interested to hear everyone else's thoughts about, was this question of Caucasians being kind of behind these recruitment networks, because this was something we did hear quite a lot. And you know, it's one that's always so difficult to kind of bottom out, because to try to get the detail of that network and how it was structured. And what was one curious piece that did come out of the research was this idea that what tended to happen was initially the sort of attraction to the recruiter actually happened from a co-national, i.e. let's say a Tajik would attract other sort of Tajiks, and then he would introduce him to a sort of Caucasian who would be able to provide the structure to ultimately get the person out to you know, Syria and Iraq. And that sort of flow makes kind of logical sense, but it's just interesting because within the context of sort of radicalization in the former Soviet space, you know, the idea of these sort of dark Caucasian networks, Chechens steering everything from behind the scenes, is something that we constantly hear about. But, you know, it's very difficult often to get really hard data around it. Hmm. And that hearing about that particular step was sort of an interesting wrinkle, which makes perfect sense, but, you know, does, I thought, help clarify a little bit some of the points around that.
Yeah, that's an important aspect. You know, recruitment tools and also these means of communication and the messengers that you mentioned, would this differentiate like ethnic group to ethnic group or the location of the people that ended up being recruited there?
I mean, as much as we're able to identify, it seemed to be, I mean, these stories, I right now can't remember if it was across all 10 of the cities where we end up having researchers go, but it was quite, it did come from a few different places, and I'll be honest, I can't remember exactly which ones it was. And I don't remember there being very distinct differences between the sort of patterns in the different places. I mean, the other issue one has to, of course, remember within that context is, you know, who are you actually able to interview in each place? And that did vary. In some places, researchers just had more difficulty. And so the researcher, the subjects they ended up talking to ended up being a slightly different group of people. So in some ways, I think from our perspective, it was much more useful to look at it as a complete group rather than necessarily to break it down to the individual cities, because you started to question whether your conclusions were really definitive. I wonder if I could raise another sort of brief point, which was an interesting, which I'd be really interested to hear other people's points about, was the question of the role of the internet and the role of social media, because again, this was something that was constantly sort of referred to. And an interesting wrinkle, which I thought was interesting within this conversation, again, it was quite difficult to talk about within our sort of group, was this idea that, you know, a lot of the people who our researchers were talking to would say that, you know, the internet is actually more accessible to them and more open in many ways in Russia than in parts of Central Asia. And so actually the sort of corollary of this was that actually by being more open, this meant that it was more easy for them to access radical material, which was a sort of interesting wrinkle onto it. Because then, of course, trying to, you know, discuss this within the context of this, you know, well, in a way, it's because Russia is a more open place in some of these discussions than actually some Central Asian countries. But in a way, that seemed to be something that was creating a potential problem. But it was a sort of interesting wrinkle in some ways to the discussion, which did present us some questions when we were trying to think forwards about what kind of recommendations one could advance for this.
Interesting. Wow. Thank you very much, Rafael. So the report also discusses about the source of resilience, various organizations and people who have a positive influence on migrant laborers. So let's discuss about this and also current trends among Central Asian militants in regard to their attraction towards militants in Syria. But let's continue the Majlis talking about this and many other questions shortly. First, let me recap the discussion that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast, we are discussing Central Asian militants in the Middle East conflict in the light of the recent report published by the Royal United Services Institute. Joining me in the discussion are Rafael Pantucci, Director of the Institute's International Studies, and Marinta Mels, Researcher at the George Mason University, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. So let's start with you again, Rafael. The report also talks about this source of resilience among the community in the form of organization, in the form of people of influence. Could you explain some of this, who these people are, how did they prevent migrants from joining these extremist groups?
I mean, this was one of the really kind of positive stories to come out of the research, in a way. Was the way we tried to do this research was to try to look, as I say, at the kind of milieu in which radicalization takes place. And so when you're looking at the milieu, one of the questions you ask is, well, why does what in this milieu is maybe stopping people from going to join? Because as we all know, if you talk about sort of the broad trends of why people join extremist groups, you know, anger against injustices, you know, a lot of people are potentially touched on by these ideas, but ultimately only a very few make the decision to actually go and participate in sort of extremist groups. So the question of resilience is to try to understand a little bit why that is happening. So why is it people aren't sort of going? And within the context of this research, one of the really interesting aspects that came out was this phenomenon that, you know, actually when you started to get down to the sort of group level and the community level, you found that there were some very strong leaders in these sorts of communities who very much felt they had a sort of pastoral responsibility over the kind of co-nationals that they had in their community. These are kind of foremen of work crews, you know, who would sort of, you know, be the local Tajik, you know, man who would help others kind of figure out, you know, what was wrong with their papers or try to help them figure out their housing or, you know. And another thing that they would do would be to try to make sure that, you know, if there was a sort of bad influence that was sort of coming into the community, to try to get rid of them or try to push them away. And these sorts of community leaders, you know, who were very organic in terms of their appearance in many cases, or in a lot of the cases we found, you know, these were really sort of organic figures who developed from the community, but they were playing a really positive role. And in some ways, we thought this was kind of an underappreciated role within these communities, not only in helping everyone with their sort of practical matters of, you know, helping deal with the difficulties of being a labor migrant in Russia, but, you know, also helping protect these communities in some ways from problems of radicalization, you know, and stop keeping, you know, bad influences out, you know. And so it was a really interesting question to see that these particular figures played such a sort of positive role. The other aspect, which is also important to mention, I think, is that, you know, while there was clear evidence that, you know, people find the migration experience to Russia a very difficult one, you know, the legal process is clearly rigged and in some is rigged in some cases, and there's clearly evidence of abuses of the system, you know, there was also some clear instances where people would say, well, actually, you know, there is the local officer, police officer in our area who's been really helpful, you know, and has actually been quite good at sort of maintaining contact with the sort of people within the community and helping provide, again, that kind of resilience role in terms of protecting people from being, you know, recruited to go off and fight in these communities. So, you know, I think our key point was that there was this kind of underappreciated role that was emerging amongst these communities. And, you know, in so much as it's possible, it would be something that, you know, would be good to try to help nurture and support, because it is acting as a sort of a, you know, as a prophylactic in some ways in some of these places to prevent recruiters from being successful or from people just sort of going off and finding radical ideas and going off to Syria and Iraq.
Very interesting.
I'd like to add something to that. Yeah. I think what's interesting is a lot of the report did say that these were organic, that maybe they were a foreman, maybe they're a diaspora leader. And with Russia, there's many, many diaspora leaders from all of the different countries, not just Central Asia, but the Caucasus, all the former Soviet republics, as well as Afghanistan and Pakistan and China. And those groups aren't, they may look organic, but they're, I don't think we can say that they're necessarily organic, because they are formally linked into the state structures and the anti-terrorism structures. So, for instance, the country has the Council of Nationalities, Council of Nationality Affairs, which is a state government structure where all the diaspora leaders work within those structures. And then, so, and then those diaspora leaders will often work on anti-terrorism efforts together. For instance, after the St. Petersburg attack, the representatives from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan that were all part of the state structure but are considered diaspora leaders in the diaspora community met with Shamsel Saraliyev, who is a Chechen minister to work on anti-terrorism issues. And so I think they are nurtured by the state as a matter of course to protect from terrorism within the country and from radicalization.
That's interesting. Bruce, your thoughts on this?
Well, you know what? The only thing I would probably add to that is that certainly among the Uzbek migrant population, I've heard people say many, many times that they felt that a lot of their groups had been infiltrated, for lack of a better word, that the Uzbek government, the SNB at the time, now it's got a different abbreviation, an acronym. But and I'm sure this was true from with the Tajikistan, too, that they had sent spies to go out among them, too, you know, and monitor what the migrant laborers were doing, what mosques they were going to, what the imams were saying at the mosques that these people were going to, you know, and keeping track of this kind of stuff. So there's, you know, like I said, there's no hardcore evidence about this, but it's certainly one of the things that a lot of migrant laborers believe is going on, you know. And I appreciated Marintha's comment about them sending officials out. I remember in the case of Tajikistan, the Tajik government just about half a year ago or a little more, sent their top clerics out to do work with the migrant communities in some of the Russian cities, admittedly at the request of the Russian mufti. But nonetheless, they felt, you know, that they had to go out there and meet with their own co-nationals and talk to them and explain to them the evils of extremism and mixing with some questionable people out there. So, you know, there definitely is a government effort from Central Asia, too, to kind of monitor these people and keep tabs on what they're doing when they're out there working in Russia.
I would add this is I think this should be considered part of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement, which was established. You know, they have part of the structure is to counter radicalism and extremism. And that these things were put in place as far as early as 2000, when Russia first started the CIS anti-terror organization to work with these countries. And I think this has just been carried over in a different way within the diaspora communities that are officially part of the state structure now. So I thought it was interesting within the report they said, like, there's the all Uzbek national diaspora group, and one of the women that was a respondent in the report said that her husband was going to open an affiliate in the city that she was in. And I think that's what it is. And then we also know that the diaspora leaders within these countries and within Russia, within the cities, each city, they have to go register with the city as a diaspora leader. So they're very much connected to the Russian state as far as in security services to weed out extremism.
But Rafael, obviously you want to respond to some of the comments made since you spoke. And also, have you heard anything from the people that you spoke to about the potential connection between these influential community leaders and the states back in their home or in Russia? And what was the impression about them?
I mean, I think that, you know, certainly all of the stories that I think the others have mentioned, you know, resonate. And I think that there is certainly, you know, a level of state control that goes on. I mean, another project we did earlier, a year or so ago, was looking specifically at Uzbekistan. And this was kind of when we talked to people in Tashkent about, you know, the question and problem of radicalization amongst, you know, Central Asian labor migrants. They would quite openly talk about the fact that they were, you know, trying to reach out to Russia. They were sending imams. They were trying to, you know, implicit there was other things going on as well. So, you know, it would make 100% sense. And, you know, I think that in Uzbekistan, for example, in particular, their focus on developing up the Mahalla system as their way of, you know, trying to implement what you could describe as a countering violent extremism strategy, I think is a reflection of their kind of using community structures to try to, you know, maintain some level of control and try to maintain some level of, you know, understanding of what's sort of going on. And if you think about the size of these diaspora communities that exist in Russia, it makes perfect sense that you would continue to maintain that sort of push across the border. I know some of the workshops that we did in Moscow, you know, it was very clear that the sort of local embassies were quite sort of interested in the research and sort of involved as well. So I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised that any of this was sort of happening. But what I would also say is what was interesting was looking at some of the stories from the ground, you know, when people were referring to some of these more positive experiences or, you know, how this foreman was actually helping with this, that, and the other, there wasn't that much reference to this sort of being a sort of method of control. It was expressed in a more positive light. You know, it was expressed in the sense of, oh, well, you know, he helped me with these problems with my papers when they came about, and also he was great in trying to make sure this group of kids didn't go off the track. You know, so it was expressed in that way rather than necessarily being expressed as a sort of state control methodology, though again, I don't doubt that there is some sort of linkages, you know, when we think about the numbers of people involved and the fact that we are seeing some of them going off and showing off in Syria and Iraq and becoming involved in terrorist activities, and we think of the security services in the countries that we're talking about, it would be surprising if they did not, try to exert some sort of control through these structures as well.
Yeah. For some reason, we ended up talking about this a lot. But one last question about this. Apart from the community leaders, Rafael, in general, would the sources of this resilience would change community to community, or they are the same, similar trends?
I'm thinking, I don't recall that there was a huge distinction, frankly, between the different communities when I was thinking about resilience questions. It did seem fairly broadly universal how it was expressed itself. Mm. I mean, you know, there was a degree to which I think an interesting aspect, maybe this maybe goes beyond the resilience points as well, was the lack of trust between communities. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was definitely a sense, you know, the Kyrgyz would talk about the Uzbeks in a certain way and the Uzbeks talk about the Tajiks in a certain way and so on and so forth. So there was a clear lack of trust between different communities, which meant that, you know, they clearly wouldn't, the same kind of resilience structure may be strong with one community in one place. It might not necessarily be the case or with another, because, you know, they wouldn't trust each other at all. And actually, they point to each other as potentially the source of the problems.
Terrific. Thank you very much. I think we also should be looking into the concluding discussion now. But finally, do any of you get the sense that recruitment of Central Asians to these extremist groups is fading away now that the ISIS has lost almost all of its territory in Syria and Iraq? Marinta, maybe?
I don't feel I'm qualified to speak on that. I would say, as far as Tajikistan is concerned, it seems like they're more likely to go over to Afghanistan now than Syria. So that's one thing I would say. And as far as numbers, I can't speak to the numbers.
What are the signs that makes you say that, that their attraction towards Afghanistan has increased than Syria?
This is just based on the other reports that I've read on the issue.
Okay.
I don't think that recruitment's going to grow from Russia to go to Afghanistan. I think it would just be easier for them if they're already in Tajikistan to go over. It's just a matter of logistics. And I think the report and other reports have drawn out that a lot of fighters, if they just want to go fight somewhere, they're not necessarily drawn to Syria. Mm. I mean, a lot of them end up in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something to start looking at, too.
Oh, that's interesting. I think that's a topic of another discussion, that they are going to Ukraine and the motivation and all these things. So, Rafael, the same question to you. What the current trend tells you, like in terms of attraction of Central Asian fighters toward to Syria and Iraq these days?
Well, I mean, I think the general trend we're seeing across the board is of people being less attracted to go to Syria and Iraq than before because of the changing nature of the battlefield, because of the sort of loss of territory by groups, by ISIS or, other groups as well. But I think the one aspect which I would point to is which remains interesting to me about, or particular maybe to Central Asia around this, is if the recruitment aspect is, one suspects it stays fairly constant, and I think Maritha is probably right that people are being drawn more to Afghanistan, that certainly concords with what we've been hearing. I think the ancillary point I would make is that it's interesting to look at the battlefield in Syria, and it's interesting to look at the fact that in many ways the only kind of very clearly non-Levantine, by which I mean Syrian or Iraqi group that's kind of left standing on the ground is the Turkestan Islamic Party, you know, which continues to fight in sort of parts of Idlib, continues to have, you know, fairly substantial numbers and continues to have a presence on the battlefield. You know, and this is a predominantly Uyghur group, and Uyghurs are, of course, you know, part of the sort of Central Asian community, but of course more relevant to China maybe than Central Asian countries. But what's interesting about them is that we can see that they have started to, as I say, they've remained standing as the last sort of non-local organization fighting kind of on the battlefield in Syria, but they've started to increasingly put out material in other languages, including Russian and Kyrgyz. And there seems to be some evidence that there are some Central Asians fighting with them. And, you know, what that means is very difficult to interpret. It could just be that they've sort of absorbed the Central Asian fighters there. But there's some questions around how much that group could become kind of the banner carrier for Central Asians more broadly in the sort of global jihadist movement. I think that poses some interesting questions. But I would suspect around recruitment and radicalization, you know, history tells us these things stay fairly constant, and it's just the battlefield where people go that tends to shift.
Now, Rafael, you also mentioned that this group started putting out some materials in public. So what does that material tell you about the intention, since they are kind of incorporating Central Asian militants into the group?
it's very difficult to know, because the sort of material that they put out seems to be, it's still in the mode of sort of trying to attract people to the group, trying to broadcast the group's message, which you suspect is about recruitment and fundraising. But, you know, I think it it also speaks to the fact that the group has become more broad, and in the sense that, you know, it's not just a sort of Uyghur organization. You know, they're now putting out material in these other languages, and it's possible, therefore, that you're seeing people from these other places who are participating in the group. And, you know, the more they become involved, the more the organization could be steered potentially to do attacks in other places. I mean, it's worth remembering, you know, that the sort of only real substantial terrorist attack we've seen in Central Asia recently was the, you know, attempted car bombing of the Chinese embassy in Bishkek, which was conducted by a group of Uyghurs who had seemingly traveled back from Syria, who were using Central Asian passports to do that. And the sort of support network around them was, I think, in some part Central Asian as well. So, you know, I think there is a potential threat there that is interesting and is, I think, going beyond maybe just Xinjiang.
Okay. Final words from Bruce.
Thank you. Well, certainly, Syria and Iraq have lost their attraction. I think if you're really given to going and trying to wage jihad, if you've been convinced that this is what you should do, there's not much of a future there. You know, from talking to our Afghan service, for what it's worth, they seem to think that there is a route through northern Iran that will get you into Afghanistan, and that might explain some of the Uzbek fighters and even these rumors of Uyghur fighters as far away as Badakhshan, since I doubt that they crossed from the Chinese border. They crossed the Chinese border through the Wahan corridor and ended up, you know, in the lowlands of Badakhshan province. So that might be that there actually is a way for these fighters to escape from Iraq and Syria and end up in Afghanistan. Marintha makes a good point. You know, Tajikistan is a porous border, and with the closure of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, the banning of the party, you know, that you had to figure that there was going to be some people who figured their future was not looking good staying in Tajikistan, and they're better casting their lot in with some of the people south of the border. It would be much harder for Uzbeks to cross from Uzbekistan into Afghanistan. I would imagine, you know, it's not a very long border. Uzbek security force is pretty efficient after all this time. Hard for me to believe that they would be able to get across that particular border. But certainly, I think the days of people flying Central Asian migrant laborers flying from Russia to Turkey and then trying to sneak across the border into Syria probably coming to an end. Which doesn't mean that the whole battle's over. It's just, you know, as Rafaela suggested, it's shifting to a new area, but I don't think there's that much attraction anymore to going toward what is clearly a losing cause, you know, in Syria and Iraq.
Yeah. I thought this would be our final comment, but Bruce, you raised another interesting question. I would like to take, Rafael, your thoughts and also Marintha, yours. So in the light of this going forwards, what you would be looking at?
I think that going forwards, I think I'm going to be very interested to see the degree to which we see ISIS in Afghanistan in particular start to establish enough of a footprint to be able to have the same sort of attractive power that you saw happening in Syria and Iraq previously. Because I think at the moment it's not very clear to me the degree to which we can definitively say that ISIS in Afghanistan is, you know, basically just another faction in a ongoing conflict that we see in that country, or whether it's going to be able to become kind of, you know, the banner carrier of the global ISIS organization, as we see the ISIS organization in Syria really recede back. So I think that's going to be, in Syria and Iraq, sorry, recede right back. So I think that's going to be an interesting question for me. And then the other one is understanding what is really going to end up happening with this sort of much more strength in Turkestan Islamic Party and what they end up doing and how they end up moving beyond their presence on the battlefield in Syria, or if they will just remain sort of one of the groups fighting there. I mean, they've got this footprint in Afghanistan as well, but, you know, how might that express itself, and then what that means for, you know, broader jihadist groups in Central Asia.
Okay. Marintha, last point?
I think my curiosity lies in if fighters are really coming from Iran, through Iran, what role is Iran playing? That would be one of my questions. And then my other question is really just watching what Russia is doing in Tajikistan to help shore up Tajikistan. What kind of military support and other things are they doing there that would be indicative that they're concerned about a threat from ISIS in the region and what they are doing to stop radicalization into Afghanistan.
Okay, Bruce, this is final. So what you will be looking at now going forward?
You know, I think I've already made this point before in previous conversations, but if these guys really are going to move the battlefield from Iraq and Syria and try to get into Afghanistan, they're sooner or later they're going to have to hold ground. You know, and they can't so far in Afghanistan. I mean, one of the reasons they were so successful in Syria and Iraq was they were able to capture fairly large towns and cities and hold on to them for a while, and that has not been the case in Afghanistan. I mean, there's only that one district in northern Afghanistan that they've been able to hold on to, and their leader was just killed a month or so ago. It seems to me like they're going to end up being absorbed probably into other groups or forming some new kind of group. I don't know. But as ISIS, I don't know. These are dangerous people. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to sell them short. They are extremely dangerous, and they're desperate. They got nothing to lose at this point. But so far, at least in Afghanistan, probably because they have to fight the government and the Taliban, who are both well acquainted with the terrain and have fighting experience, it's a much more formidable challenge for them than it seems like certainly it was in Syria when they first arrived.
Okay, thank you very much for your insights, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. And also big thanks goes to Rafael Pantucci, director of Royal United Services Institute's International Security Studies, and Marinta Miles, researcher at the George Mason University. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.